Today, it's exactly a year since the British co-founder of the internationally celebrated White Helmets took his own life. We look at the pressures facing James LeMessurier in the run-up to his death and ask what it means for the humanitarian group now. Let me start with a warning. This episode begins with a scene in which someone takes their own life. If you feel affected by anything you hear, you can call the Samaritans on 116 123 or email joe@samaritans.org.
Just before sunrise on 11th of November 2019, a thumping on her iron door awoke Emma Winberg from a brief sleep. She ran to the window. She looked to the right, and then she looked left, and she could see down below in the gloom the body of her husband lying still on cobblestones. She hurriedly got dressed. She ran downstairs. She opened the first of two security doors, and she was rushing towards the second when it burst open, and five police officers rushed towards her, holding her back as she tried to run past them. She looked over their shoulders, and she could see her husband, James LeMessurier, lying where he fell, naked. And Emma Winberg says that that was the worst moment of her life. She was trying to tell the policeman to put a blanket over him, but she was pushed back upstairs into a workspace on the second floor of the three-story building in which they lived and worked. Her DNA was taken, her fingerprints were taken, and for the next 5 hours, she was treated as a murder suspect.
Now, we turn our attention to Istanbul in Turkey, because James LeMessurier, the co-founder of the White Helmets in Syria, has been found dead in a street there.
James LeMessurier fell to his death exactly a year ago today, on November the 11th, 2019. The Guardian's Martin Chulove knew James well through his work as the British co-founder of a renowned rescue group working in Syria. The White Helmets had long been seen as a beacon of humanitarianism in the middle of a brutal civil war. A charity that had attracted worldwide praise and had even been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
To save one life is to save humanity. That is their motto. A quote from the Quran.
But it was also an organisation with powerful enemies.
The Syrian army was fighting the terrorists. The same face of the same one in the white helmets was a fighter with Al-Qaeda.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, a Syrian disinformation war and the untimely death of an internationally celebrated British humanitarian.
James LeMessurier was a man who had devoted much of his life to humanitarian causes in the Middle East. He was a British Army officer. He was born to the son of a colonel of the Royal Marines. He went to Sandhurst, where he did well in 1993, graduated top of his class.
From today, you are entrusted by your monarch and your country to show courage in the command nation's soldiers.
He was soon sent to Kosovo, where he was a staff officer. He left the military and he moved to the Middle East, where one of his first assignments was to run a private prison in the West Bank. And for a year or so, LeMessurier based himself in Amman, where he was working on the traditional models of foreign security companies, these large compounds. And after 2 years, he became tired of what he saw as models that were not doing anything to stabilise or to bring any sort of security to local populations. They were just self-serving foreign operations that generated money for expatriate soldiers such as himself. So LeMessurier left, moving gradually into the humanitarian sphere. And by 2013, as the Syrian civil war was intensifying, he was approached by groups of Syrians from the north of the country who were being routinely bombed and were looking for help in how to rescue people from the rubble. This was finally a model that James thought that he could support. This was local volunteers doing local work, people shaping their own destinies.
These are ordinary individuals, ordinary walk of life professions, former bakers, former builders, former students, who had choices as to what they were going to do with their lives within the revolution. And these individuals chose to stay with very little equipment and at the beginning with no training whatsoever to respond to bomb attacks, respond to shellings, and to try to save their fellow Syrian civilians.
James quit his job, relocated to Turkey, and set up Mayday Rescue, which was the foundation that would train and sustain the organisation that would later grow into the White Helmets.
They choose as volunteers really to run towards the danger when the rest of the civilian population is trying their very hardest to get away. And they recognised very early on that in many cases, while there were a lot of lives that were rescued, they didn't have the necessary skills and training. There were a lot of spinal injuries at the very beginning. And so there is training that can be provided. There is equipment that can be provided that can increase the number of successful rescues.
How had he met Emma, his wife?
Emma Winberg was a British diplomat who worked for 6 years at the Foreign Office. She left government and moved to Iraq, where she was working for a communications company whose aim was to disrupt the Islamic State group, which was running rampant throughout the region at the time. 2 years later, she approached James Lemessurier, seeking his help for a potential project to stabilise communities above the Mosul Dam back in Iraq, where it was feared that the dam was about to collapse. The two started talking about work, but that turned into a very long evening, and both Lemessurier and Winberg subsequently told me that by the time the fourth bottle of wine had been ordered, there wasn't any more work discussion. They were starting to plan their lives together. So the work project didn't work out, but the personal project did.
And Martin, you knew James personally, didn't you? You were friends. Tell me about how you met.
We met in person when I sought him out for a meeting, as I say, in September 2018. It was clear from the first time I met him that he was overburdened by, I thought, spreading himself so thin for so many years. He was deeply fatigued, but he was still trying very hard to make as much time as he could. And he was a very intelligent, committed humanitarian. He was somebody whose values I respected instinctively, and very quickly we formed a very firm friendship. We'd meet in restaurants in Istanbul. We also met in Erbil in northern Iraq in the week before he died. And at that time, James and Emma were looking to come up with a model which might support the Kurds of northern Iraq, and in particular how to deal with such large numbers of refugees from so many conflicts over so many years.
Tell me about that meeting in Iraq in the week before he died.
On the Tuesday, which would have been the 5th of November, we sat in the lobby of the Erbil Rotana in northern Iraq. We had a bottle of wine in the evening, and James was looking at a book on nautical knots. And as we continued with the wine, we'd talk about, you know, our shared experiences, our near misses over the years. And he was very much settling into the evening. He had some urgent business to attend to when he got back to Istanbul, but that was a night in which he was prepared to shake that off and just sit with friends. And at midnight, we all went to our rooms, Emma and James to theirs, mine to my room. And then the following morning, which would have been the Wednesday, all three of us were in the lobby, and I looked at him, and he was holding a cup of coffee, and I said, "What happened?" And he had this deeply furrowed brow. He looked distressed, and he said he'd had some intense conversations after midnight with parts of the audit team, and he was worried that things weren't going to go well when he got back to Istanbul.
I guess to understand what James was about to walk into, we need to understand the company he had built. A company that had become his life, Mayday Rescue, that trained and supported Syrian volunteers and built the defence group we now know as the White Helmets. Tell me about them. What was it that made them different to other aid organisations working in Syria?
The White Helmets became a brand without that ever being the intention.
When the bombs rain down on Syria, these are the brave volunteers who run in. Nicknamed the White Helmets, they claw and saw their way through the rubble to save those buried beneath.
What stood them out from other groups is that they filmed what they did with cameras strapped to their heads. So very soon we had these terrifying scenes of women and children and others being dragged from the rubble of airstrikes within minutes of these strikes having taken place. And this humanized the people who were being bombed, and it made it very inconvenient for Assad and for the Russians, who were trying to delegitimize everybody that was being attacked beneath their jets. They were painting all of those who were being hit as terrorists or their supporters. Instead, we were seeing these raw scenes of real people, many of them injured. And it really did start to eat into the narrative that all those on the ground in Idlib in particular were terrorists.
These volunteers say they've saved 60,000 people in Syria. Now more than 130 organisations have backed the White Helmets to win the Nobel Peace Prize.
On an international basis, the White Helmets had attracted huge recognition, and with that, financial support, hadn't they?
Yeah, the financial support came from far and wide, and it built right through to 2018 and 19. 18 was the year where they were received roughly $30 million in funding, and that was from the British government, from Germany.
They are fantastically brave, these White Helmets. I'm proud to say we're giving them another, I think, £32 million.
There were bits and pieces from the Turks, and there was a documentary for Netflix, which won the Academy for Best Documentary.
And the Oscar goes to the White Helmets.
As what you were describing was happening, the White Helmets were continuing to gain praise and funding from many Western governments. Attacks from Assad's supporters within the Syrian government, but also among allies in Russia and Iran, intensified with conspiracy theories about the group, didn't they?
The counter-narrative that the White Helmets were part of a subversive plot to oust Assad, they were an organisation that was a Trojan horse for jihadists backed by the West, became prevalent.
The White Helmets are supported by the British government. They're giving them money. And they're famous for staging fake chemical attacks. That's exactly what happened, you know, in Han Shenhun.
The records expose White Helmets as perhaps one of the most extensive and elaborate deceptions in modern war propaganda.
Probably one of the greatest propaganda constructs of this war that was primarily created by the British government.
Does James really have the Syrian people's best interests at heart? If so, why do the White Helmets operate solely in terrorist-held areas?
And that narrative started to take root soon after the Russians formally joined the conflict, which was September 2015. At that point, Assad was several weeks away from losing the heartland of Syria for him, and that was the area in which his ancestral village was, Kardaha, in the northwest of the country.
Kardaha's loyalty to the Assads is based in their shared Alawite religion. Hundreds of young men from here volunteered to fight in Syria's grinding war. 4 years in, these are the faces of those who won't come back.
At that point, Vladimir Putin committed his air force to the conflict, and for the next 6 months, a very intensive bombing of opposition groups. And a intensification of the disinformation campaign, which very heavily went after the White Helmets and James Lemessurier personally.
Welcome to a RT International World Exclusive. I'm with the president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad.
Just before he died, Assad was making claims on TV that the White Helmets were al-Qaeda and they ate the hearts of people they came across.
And one of them was being eating the heart of a soldier. I mean, this is very common to see on the internet. The evidence, I mean, if no one in this region believed the stunt, the PR stunt of the White Helmets. They are offshoot of al-Nusra.
Were the White Helmets attracting people from terrorist groups?
There were hardline conservative groups who benefited from having an organisation such as the White Helmets in the province there. They did not try to infiltrate them, but they were happy for them to operate. So they gave them what we call an Arabic waster or aegis, and allowed them to do what they do. But the very fact that these groups did exist then and continue to exist now in the same areas in which the White Helmets were operating became troublesome for this organization, because they were continually forced to defend the assertion that they were one and the same, that there was no daylight between them. They've always made a very clear distinction between themselves and the groupings and the armed opposition there. And they say that they're just there to support local communities. And that's a position that they cling to. It was certainly something which Lemessurier was certain about. And there was a lot of assurance that was going on to donor governments as the war wound on, and as political will to support the Syrian opposition waned, that this was an effort which was supporting local populations. It wasn't sustaining the war.
Do we know how the volunteers and the people working for the White Helmets were affected by these stories? And do we know how James was affected?
This clearly took a toll. It made their working environment very, very dangerous to start with. I mean, wherever they went, they were being targeted by the Russian Air Force or the Syrians. It became difficult for them to operate in some parts of the north of Syria and across the border into Turkey. The White Helmets leader, Raad Saleh, told me that this took a very heavy toll on him. It was an emotional burden that he continues to carry. But with Lemessurier, he spent a lot of time on social media and reading through comments, and I always used to advise him to ignore it because, if you took seriously what was written about you there, then I don't see how you could ever function. It was clear that this background noise, this constant drumbeat of slurs and slander that he was waking up to every day, was taking a significant toll on him.
And there were also questions about how May Day, the organisation James had set up to train the White Helmets and financially support them, was being run, weren't there?
There were questions about May Day's structure, whether it had the right financial controls or systems in place. This is early 2019. There was an audit ordered by the British government. That audit was produced in June last year, 2019, and it came up with recommendations to reduce salaries by roughly 10%, to come up with more robust financial systems. And James was under a lot of pressure to come up with a financial regime that could satisfy an environment where politicians were starting to become fatigued of the Syrian war, which was just dragging on seemingly forever, and looking for more and more reasons to walk away from their commitment to any funding there. And that was something that became difficult for diplomats to actually come to terms with, because they were very heavily committed to the projects, but the politicians back home were losing patience.
Let's go back to that moment in Iraq when you were with James. Clearly, he had heard something bad to make his whole demeanour shift like that. Do you know what he had found out on that phone call?
James knew that he was returning from Iraq to deal with a second team of auditors who had been invited to inspect the group's finances by the then chief financial officer, Johan Elleveld. There'd been some tensions in the week earlier, accusations that Elleveld had been in conflict with other staff members. So when they got back to Istanbul, there was a meeting with the auditors and with the financial officer, which left Lemessurier traumatized and thinking that he was about to lose control of the foundation that he had built.
How did you hear that he died?
It was Monday morning, and since the previous Friday, 3 days earlier, I'd been in touch with James. I sent him a message on the Friday afternoon asking how things were, and he replied with a very strange, "It's been a very rough couple of days for us. I think we could lose May Day more soon, comrade." So I let that be. I just said, "I'm here if you need me." And on the Saturday and the Sunday, Emma Winberg called me several times, and we had long conversations, and I wanted to get to the bottom of what the issues were, what had distressed him so much, and what was bothering her. James had been taken to a medical centre near their home. He'd been sedated on the Saturday because of the panic attacks that he was having and the extreme anxiety. He really did think that somehow he'd lost control of the foundation and it was all upon him. And Monday morning I sent Emma a message saying, How are things today? Emma called me straight away and the conversation went, Hi, Emma. Hi, Martin. How's things today, Emma? James is dead. And the silence that followed for the next 10 seconds was ghastly, and it seemed like many minutes, and I didn't know how to respond, and I just made arrangements to get to Istanbul, and I flew there late that afternoon, and we met along with her family who had flown in from London and her friends who had arrived from Iraq and elsewhere, and we sat in the lobby of a hotel and we tried to talk things through and console her.
As you were travelling to see Emma and the family, and when you got there, what was going through your mind?
I just couldn't believe what had taken place, and I couldn't understand why it had. There were no answers. There were many, many questions. I'd seen them 5 days earlier when Emma and James had gotten back to Istanbul. I'd dropped them off in a taxi. We'd caught the same flight back from Iraq. And as James got out of the taxi, I got his bag out of the trunk for him and put it on the ground. He gave me a hug and said, "See you, brother." And it was a very busy road, and yet I insisted to the taxi driver that he pulled over. And I watched as James and Emma walked across the road towards their building, which is just next to the mosque. And he was very stooped, and he almost looked defeated. It didn't sit well with me, so I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't work out why it was wrong and what was at stake.
And throughout that period, news outlets across the world reported James's death.
A former British Army officer who helped found Syria's White Helmets has been found dead in Turkey.
According to Turkish state television, Lemessurier died from the impact of falling from an upper floor of his apartment.
There are reports he fell from the balcony. How that happened is unclear.
Can you tell me about that coverage and how it affected his widow, Emma?
There was all sorts of speculation in the immediate aftermath about what had happened to James, from a murder attempt to a state-sponsored assassination, to suggestions he may have slipped and fell, and there was also speculation about suicide, which ended up being correct. The coverage was intense. The Turkish media in particular was hunting Emma for the next 3 to 4 weeks. The Russian press, no surprises, were quite celebratory in their coverage.
Tragic death for a man who made a living on tragedy.
Emma was quarantined from a lot of this by her friends, who formed a tight network around her. But it became almost a house arrest. She wasn't allowed to leave Turkey apart from to travel for the funeral in late December, just before Christmas, at a tiny family chapel in Surrey. She came home and she remained there until January, when her lawyer called and said she was free to leave for good. She'd been cleared of any suspicion of being involved in James's murder.
So it was an incredibly difficult period for her, and there were still investigations going on into May Day. Tell me what you came to understand, both about what happened in those days leading up to James's death and what has happened since.
There weren't any real answers until about May this year. A supervisory board was hired, and they aimed to get to the bottom of what had taken place with May Day's books. The supervisory board was to be led by a well-respected Dutch businessman called Cornelis Vreeswijk, who travelled to Istanbul to sit down with the chief financial officer, Johan Elleveld, who at that point was the only board member. And he needed support in trying to establish whether this was going to end up in a close down for May Day or whether there could be some form of financial rescue. Vreeswijk said that by mid-January, it had become clear that donors no longer wanted to support May Day, and at that point it did become about a closed-down plan. He started his work interviewing employees, looking through the books. Forensic accountants did the same.
And what did Cornelis discover?
When Cornelis took the role on, he was told that there were large numbers of withdrawals from May Day's accounts which were for personal use, that there could well be fraud and irregularities within the organisation, that there'd been $90,000 spent on a wedding dress, $250,000 on a speedboat, and a year-long honeymoon with pearls and handbags. And Cornelis said that he thought that he was investigating the mob at this point, and that both James and Emma were terrible people, and that he thought this was going to be a nightmare challenge. And for the next 3 months, he went through the books, and he says that by the end of his examination, he could not find a single penny missing.
So what had caused this huge investigation that left a dark cloud hanging over this organisation that James had built from scratch that was such a significant part of his life?
There were a series of questions raised about withdrawals that were made by Emma and James from Mayday's finances. One thing in particular, $50,000, which was withdrawn by James in July 2018 to take to Jordan to support the withdrawal of White Helmets from Syria into Jordan, in the minds of auditors, hadn't been fully reconciled. James had brought back a sum. It had been entered, but the paper trail hadn't been properly created. And they decided to backdate a receipt. And that was raised by the auditors as potentially something which was irregular. And after that meeting, which was the 7th of November, James had decided to front foot this and to write an email to donors in which he chose to say fraud had technically been committed within Mayday and that he would attempt to sort this out and that he apologised for it. And that was something which was used against him for the months to come. And it was something which ultimately was proven to be wrong. The money actually had been returned. And yes, while a receipt had been backdated for it, it wasn't in fact missing. It was there.
What did Cornelis conclude?
His most important finding was that there was no fraud. There was no money stolen. There was no malpractice. There may well have been some financial controls which made things a little bit opaque in places. But all of the allegations about Winberg and Lemessurier in particular were false. And this was a finding which was supported by the independent forensic accounting investigation, which came to the same conclusions.
Coming up, what will happen to the White Helmets? Essentially, after all that intense scrutiny, all that pressure, they were cleared. The Grant Thornton report did find significant gaps in the administrative organisation, including cash transactions that were not written down in cash books. But even that one payment that James flagged himself was, as you say, in the end seen as a misunderstanding. But was the damage done? What happened to Mayday? Did the donors come back?
The donors advised Cornelis in January that they would no longer support Mayday Rescue, and Mayday was placed into receivership in August. It no longer exists as a going concern, and donors are now funding the White Helmets directly. I have spoken to British officials and Canadian officials who remain robust in their support. The White Helmets are very active in Idlib province. They're still funded, they still have a budget, and they're still doing good work.
Earlier, you spoke about the Russian and Syrian disinformation campaign against James's organisation. Is that still going on?
The disinformation campaign does continue. It's not as intense as it once was. Lemessurier, in the eyes of the Russians and the Syrians, was the pantomime villain. With him out of the way, it's almost mission accomplished. But it will always be an objective of those who support the Assad regime to demonise those who stand against him and those who support communities that continue to defy him.
And for you, Martin, James was someone who was a work contact, but who became a good friend, making this incredibly personal for you. Why did you want to write about it?
This was a story of the life and death of a humanitarian, and it was important, but it was far more than that. James Lemessurier was a figure who was both lionized and vilified more than anyone else who had taken such a stake in the Syrian conflict. And he was caught up unknowingly in a particularly poisonous disinformation campaign. And his sad and tragic death, I thought, reflected the tragedy that Syria became.
And that tragedy is something that we've all watched unfold, from Assad's brutal crackdown on protesters back in 2011 through a complicated web of warring factions. It's been vicious and ultimately cost hundreds of thousands of lives. And yet, we hear less and less about Syria. What is the situation at the moment?
Well, Syria continues to be a broken and unreconciled place in which more than half of the population has been displaced. Those who have remained are dealing with a shattered economy. There is no reconstruction going on. The Syrian regime has been able to retake much of the country, fully backed by Russia from above and the Iranian proxies on the ground who have done a lot of the heavy lifting. But will this country ever be put back together? Will it ever be a place in which those who fled the fighting or those who opposed the regime can actually return and be part of a nation state under the same leader? Big questions. And at this point, the answer seems to be no. It's a war that has really changed the nature of the Middle East. It bled directly out of the conflict in Iraq. It fed the rise and then the defeat of the Islamic State. It has left a splintered and broken place in which it seems impossible at this juncture that those who fought each other can reconcile. And if that is going to happen, it's not going to be in coming years. And that means that there will be an ongoing need for support from foreign governments for those who continue to be victims of the fighting in Syria.
Martin, you've told me about how James's work is carrying on through the White Helmets. Today marks exactly 1 year since he died. How is Emma doing?
Emma Winberg's relocated to Amsterdam. She's living a simple life of solitude at this point. She keeps a shrine to James in which his ashes are the centrepiece. There are candles surrounding it. There are photos. She remains very deeply affected by what happened to her husband and the death of the love of her life. Somebody who to her was a true partner in every aspect. Everything they did was for each other. The disinformation continues. There are relentless efforts to target her as an extension of James, but she is starting to do a bit better. For her, it's a very slow recovery process and an ongoing grieving process, and I think that will be the case for a long time to come.
Martin, I'm very sorry for your loss as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Martin Chulove, who has written all about this in a long read at theguardian.com. It's called How Syria's Disinformation Wars Destroyed the Co-Founder of the White Helmets. It's really powerful. Do also keep up with Martin's work and others in the Middle East to understand what is happening in Syria today. And if you have time, I also recommend one of our previous Today in Focus episodes on the conflict called The Five Brothers Forced Apart by the War in Syria with Michael Safi. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.